Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Courtney Duke Foster, author of Passing Notes, her first novel. Courtney is a lawyer and fiction writer. Bitten by the writer bug a few years ago, she has written dozens of poems and short stories. She is a graduate of Spelman College and Duke University School of Law. And Courtney, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So Courtney, why don't you start us off with giving us a description of what the book is about?
Okay, absolutely. It's Passing Notes. You have two best friends fresh out of college in 1951, kiss their families goodbye in DC, and they board a train headed for New York City, seeking job opportunities free from the shackles of Jim Crow. Unfortunately, they find out quickly that New York has its own brand of racism that is just as oppressive as what they had experienced back home. But one of the friends, being fair-skinned, allows her to take advantage of opportunities that were unavailable to her darker-skinned friend. And basically, most of the book is seeing her manage the anxiety and consequences of living a lie. So essentially, the book is about passing for white in the early 1950s. But it's not only about that. It's also about colorism and sexism, friendship and romance, and also work and family dynamics, all the things that were relevant to our parents and grandparents being colored or Negro in America back then that are still relevant to us being Black today in America.
So I have to ask you, what was the inspiration for the novel and why set it in 1951?
Well, I've always been interested in the concept of passing, I guess. I saw the movie Imitation of Life when I was a really little girl with my mom. And it was a fascinating movie. But from then on, you know, anything that I saw or heard about, I was kind of zoned in on it. Family stories, documentaries, other books, movies. So that's kind of overall where the interest kind of, you know, came from. And then I had started writing just maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And there was, I was just writing poems and short stories. And I thought maybe I could take a stab at writing a novel. And then the ending for Passing Notes just kind of came to me one day. So I went back to see how that story might have started, where we could begin and get to that ending, which was a lot of fun, especially not knowing really what writing a novel was all about. I didn't really have any constraints of actually knowing what I was doing. So it was really more about writing a story that I've found to be interesting and getting the beginning, the middle, and the end kind of hashed out and entertaining myself. But here we are.
Well, the characters go to a historically Black college and university, North Carolina University in Durham, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And today we talk about historically Black colleges and universities. And the reality is in the 1950s and 1940s, you mostly had no other choice.
Right.
So talk about how you crafted their story, living on campus and then making it a move to New York. Did you talk to some friends or family members that went to HBCUs back in the day?
No, I went to HBCU myself. I went to Spelman College. So I used, which would have been a completely different experience going there in the 90s when I went versus going in the 50s. But I did get a sense from actually being there and talking to people who had gone there. Even my cousin who was there maybe 10 years before I was there, their rules were completely different as far as your visitors and curfews and things like that. So I just drew from my own experiences being on campus at Spelman and crafted a kind of, introductory kind of freshman year experience that young Black women might have in the 50s to get that aspect of the story.
How much time did you spend learning about the 1950s? Because, of course, I know you went to Spelman University, but I'm thinking that sometimes writers, when they're writing those stories, they talk to someone who was there. I'm sure, you know, we don't have any people that went to college in 1951, likely not alive, but, you know, people went back and forth. So how did you capture that historic moment? Because you have Adam Clayton Powell is in the book. And so you're capturing what it was like to live in New York City in the early 1950s. How did you capture that?
I did a lot of research online, particularly, but as far as the kind of college life in the 1950s, I went to look at yearbooks that, you know, are online. I used North Carolina Central, which was at the time North Carolina College, I believe. In the 50s, it changed its name to North Carolina Central. So I just went back to their old yearbooks around in and around the time that my main characters would have started there, and when they would have graduated, what people looked like, what they dressed, you know, what activities they weren't even, you know, that had full curriculum and class schedules. A lot of those books for a lot of the schools are online. So that was very, you know, advantageous to me because I could just sit and peruse the pages and kind of see myself in them back in the day. For Adam Clayton Powell and any 1950s New York kind of information, I did a lot of research online. I watched documentaries. There's also some, the characters go to Switzerland, and I've never been to Switzerland, but during the one of the characters was a World War II veteran. There was actually a little documentary about, World War II after, you know, Switzerland after World War II when he was there. So I was able to watch that and, piece those real life aspects and weave them into the tapestry of this Passing Notes.
So how would you describe Cheryl, the protagonist? And I'm assuming that that was the first character you created when you started working on the novel, or I could be wrong.
Well, since the ending, the ending came to me first. So I had the idea for John and Cheryl, at first, but he doesn't appear in the initial pages of the chapters of the novel.
I got to stop you real quick. So for the benefit of our audience, John is the person she falls in love with who works at the publishing company that she works at. And he's a white man.
Absolutely. How would I describe Cheryl? I think that she's smart. She's kind of shy. She has been a little bit shy around people because of the experiences that she's had and the way she's been treated by people in her own community, Black people, as well as white people. She is the character that is passing in the book. So I think for her at the time as a young woman, just starting out in her career, she is in a situation where she's making a choice of what she wants to do, knowing that the choices are limited for women, especially Black women in the 50s. She was scheduled and ready to be a teacher, and then this other opportunity came about. And she really hadn't thought of herself outside of that context of being an educator, because that is the pigeonhole that she was put into throughout her education. So when this opportunity comes up, she's willing to go for it. But I think she's really trepidatious and anxious about stepping out and experiencing the world. So she's quiet. She likes to read. She is intelligent and she comes into her own and finds her voice and a direction, I think, in this throughout the book, and grows, matures quite quickly over the course of less than 2 years, I believe, that the book covers.
And her best friend, Betty, is the opposite, vivacious, bold, right, outgoing, willing to take chances. And she helps to bring Cheryl out of her shell, right?
She does. She does serve that purpose for Cheryl in her life, where Cheryl likes to sit and read on a Saturday night. Betty will encourage her to sneak out and have a night on the town. And she is the extroverted party girl who's also smart and ambitious and career driven. And that is a very influential to Cheryl and the choices that she ends up making in the book as well.
So the book is set at a publishing company where she goes to work, Bird's Eye Publishing, I believe is the name of it. And it's a startup. And that's where she meets John, who is one of the editors. How long did it take for you to figure out how you wanted this meet to happen? Was that something that was organic as you were writing the story, just came up? Or did you think about how you wanted them to meet?
Oh, for sure. I thought about every detail of that so that it could be realistic. I wanted it to be realistic and also compelling and entertaining for the reader. But the main focus was to make sure that it flowed appropriately in the storyline, and that it started in a place where it would get me to the ending that I had envisioned as well. So I had to think, you know, even from the very beginning, having the end idea, at first, but I had to construct the entire thing. So the idea of the publishing company was something that I had to think about very, consider, you know, very seriously too, because like, what kind of job would they have? What could kind of place could they work in where you'd have, you know, kind of your entry level employees have an opportunity to interact with senior level employees? And it's just, you know, as a writer, this made sense for me and was interesting to pursue kind of what it might be like to work at a publishing company in the 50s, you know? So it was a very, you know, thoughtful process in, you know, how they would work together and how they might kind of build from that meet cute, a relationship could bud from their work relationship, so to speak.
The anxiety, I really feel the anxiety of Cheryl as I read the novel, because there's so many different struggles she has to deal with. One is just not wanting to run into any Black people because she's afraid she's going to run into someone she knows when she's out with John. Two, the enormous guilt she feels about not being honest with her family. But at the same time, Betty sort of helps her along that path, really sort of. And the title Passing Notes, I believe, comes from the notes that Betty is getting to Cheryl so they can have their regular meets in the bathroom to catch up. So talk a bit about how you balanced her feelings of guilt and the struggle with not really being able to see her family and the anxiety. And as a writer, I do want to ask you this, and it might seem like sort of a, why are you asking me this? But do you feel the anxiety that your characters feel when you're writing that story?
Oh, definitely. So a couple of questions you have in there. Passing Notes is definitely kind of a play on what actually is happening in the book. A lot of the characters, especially Betty and Cheryl, communicate by sending notes to each other, kind of their coded cryptic messages of when they want to meet. If Cheryl is feeling anxious, feeling like someone might have discovered her secret at work, she sends notes to Betty to meet her in their secret place, so that Betty can calm her down and assure her that no one knows anything and she hadn't heard anything, because with the understanding that, you know, Betty is a lower level employee. She works with other lower level Black employees that roam the building pretty freely, but are also typically kind of invisible at that time. So they pick up on things and hear things that other employees don't necessarily get the information for. So the notes between Betty and Cheryl are very important in helping Cheryl get through this this decision that she's made to pass. There's also the notes that are passed between Cheryl and John as they get to know each other. They send little letters and share kind of reading material with each other initially, and as they get to know each other. And then Cheryl in the 50s, of course, she communicates regularly with her family, writing letters. So it's there's a lot of notes that go back and forth and passing notes. And then your last question was, I can't remember. What did you ask? As a writer, you said, Okay, I remember now. You asked, do I feel the anxiety of my characters? Well, I certainly try to. Like, I literally try to feel like what it would be like in this situation. And that's all of them, even the less desirable ones. Like, what I try to put myself in their shoes with their experiences and how they might have been brought up and what this situation that they're facing looks like and what it feels like to be them. So that, I think, helps me with how they communicate and in the dialogue between characters as well. I could try to vacillate back and forth, you know, pretending to be each one of the characters as I'm writing it.
So let's talk about the less desirable character in the book, Donnie.
Okay.
And Donnie's the son of the one of the founders of the company. And to give a little bit more background on John, John was best friends with another son of the one of the founders of the company who died over in Europe during World War II. And so there's some interesting relationship there between Donnie and John, and won't go into too many details. Let's just say that you rev it up eventually.
Yes.
So talk definitely about that relationship between Donnie and John.
Well, I think it's a pretty, it's pretty easy, typical kind of, you have John who is trying to make a name for himself at the company and is liked very much by the one of the founders, who is Donnie Bird's father. And Donnie Bird's kind of like a screw up, you know, rich boy who gets his way all the time. But it, as he is growing and maturing, it's clear that he isn't putting forth quite the effort that his father would want him to. And in the sense that he might one day be in charge of the company, I think his father is hoping that he would take a little bit more responsibility for the actual details of the job he's doing. So there's some animosity that builds between the two characters because John is a bit favored, but Donnie is kind of a spoiled brat, you know, at this point. And he is also, he's the voice of a lot of the racism of the larger society, I guess, that is funneled through him and his actions and how he speaks. But he also has a kind of interesting relationship with the Black community himself. And we won't necessarily spoil that either. But he is probably the most complicated, one of the most complicated, complex characters in Passing Notes. Because of the he's kind of living a double life himself, if so to speak, you know.
Right, but John also has caused some more anxiety for Cheryl because he's progressive for that time period, And he's given her books to read by African-American authors, and she doesn't know how to respond to that. He's wanted to go to all these different events. He's trying to sign Adam Clayton Powell up to write for the publishing company. So that I thought that was an incredibly interesting take for her to fall for someone who was actually supportive of integration, supportive of races coming together. I thought that was an interesting take.
Oh yeah. And it's quite a conflict, you know, for Cheryl to try to kind of blend into this new life as a white person, at least at work at that time anyway, and then to be completely enamored with this person who just wants to bring diversity and kind of early diversity and inclusion guy at the company that, you know, is very passionate about that and bringing in Black authors and doing, you know, kind of also involved in the labor and employment movement to just equalize employment opportunities for Black people in New York at that time. That was his connection with Adam Clayton Powell Jr. in the first place. So yeah, so Cheryl does experience quite a bit of anxiety about struggling with whether or not she should tell him, because he has this, you know, he's open and he's very much not a racist and he would understand, but not wanting to burden him with her secret as well. So that is a significant conflict for her.
Well, you had one of my favorite books name checked in there, Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Gosh, I think I might have read that 30 years ago, and it's one of my favorite books. And that was one of the books where Cheryl didn't know how to react to it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And she loves the book, but she doesn't want to say anything that's going to reveal, you know, kind of what her connection is to this African-American author and or any African-Americans at all. So when he suggests this book and he gives her this book, she is not at all sure how to respond to it. And she doesn't necessarily respond very well to him, and they are left with she's left feeling terrible about how she spoke to him about the book, and he's a bit puzzled himself for, you know, how harshly she comes down on him for the book suggestions. And I also like to there's a little bit of an instruction of how, you know, the book was received, you know, as well in the white community as well as within the Black community, because it wasn't her most popular book at the time. But it is now, because we all love it and we read it, and she had, you know, resurgence of popularity, yet thanks to Alice Walker in the 70s. But in the 50s, it was a little bit of a different story for Zora Neale Hurston. So of course I wanted to include her. I thought that Their Eyes Were Watching God is a perfect fit for that interaction between Cheryl and John. And Zora Neale Hurston is my soror, by the way. So I want to give her.
Let's give a shout out. What's your sorority?
Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated.
Very good. Very good. So I thought what was also interesting is how you captured how, even though Cheryl and Betty were college graduates going out on their own, they were staying with family in New York City. There were still rules that they were expected to follow, living in the household of families that were told to watch out for them and to report back to their families in Washington, D.C. And I thought that was sort of interesting how at that point in time, you could be 22 years old, but you still had to follow the house rules.
Yes. And I think that, you know, a lot of us probably experienced some of that coming back from college as well. You know, that was, there were expectations that were that were placed on you. That's how you conduct yourself within in families and within society, and how you present yourself to the world as a representative of a particular family. And it didn't matter if you were in the town that you grew up in or wherever you ended up, you still had to be virtuous and represent your family well. So I've heard that, you know, my entire life. You know, my mom would always say, you don't know who knows me. So you have to act a certain way and present yourself a certain way. And that is definitely, the burdens and the constraints and conflict that Betty and Cheryl had to deal with. I think Cheryl was a little better at handling the rules and boundaries because she was a bit more introverted. But of course, Betty had to figure out ways and, you know, to get around the rules so that she can live her best life and experience the world the way that she intended to. But also, you know, she understood that this wasn't something that she should advertise that, you know, she was doing. So I think that was kind of fun to explore how they had to manage those conflicting interests, you know.
So the colorism you address in the novel, and I think you really do a good job of showing that there are advantages and there are also disadvantages with having the fair skin. And one of the disadvantages that character faces is not necessarily being accepted within the Black community because mm-hmm. of her fair skin. So there's two sides to that coin that I don't think we always recognize.
Yeah. I try to highlight, you know, difficulties that she experienced being fair-skinned, growing up, you know, being ostracized, otherized as a child. There were instances where, you know, she had to be protected by her big sister because her, you know, neighborhood kids would pull her hair and, you know, try to beat her up. And in school, she was, you know, told to sit over somewhere else because she could sit in the white section and things like that. But then also, you know, being a fair-skinned Black person back then, you were still a Black person and there was still segregation and those rules applied to you. But for Cheryl, she would experience there were different points in her life from being, you know, a very little girl where she was, you know, people mistook her for being white. And then when they found out she wasn't, then, you know, it was not a good thing for her. She was treated quite poorly by white people too. So she ends up feeling, you know, not accepted or out of place in both worlds.
It reminds me of the stories I've heard from authors who are from another country and live here that are of African descent. And what they say to me, I'm thinking of one in particular from Trinidad, is because she's lived in America so long that when she goes home to Trinidad, they tell her, you're not a Trinidadian anymore. She isn't treated the same. And then within the Black community, she lives in New York City, she's also treated a little bit differently. And she said the saving grace for her was, okay, her son, whose father was African-American, won't have that problem because there's sort of this liminal space she felt like she was in, not really being accepted from her home anymore, and not being accepted fully by the Native Black community.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I think that is the reason for a lot of the, you know, I think especially in New York, different neighborhoods that were for immigrants from particular countries, right? So they at least had those communities that they can draw on of people who understood what it was like to be kind of straddling between both worlds and not, you know, necessarily fitting in to either place, but they have that community to kind of that they can create those spaces where they can feel some kind of camaraderie within each other.
So writing this book, How long did it take you to write? When did you first start truly writing the manuscript for this book? And what was that process like? Did you go through, and I know I'm answering multiple questions again, but you're a lawyer. You should be. But how was that process? Was it like 25 different? Did you work it over and over and over again? Or was it a fairly easy process for you?
Well, like I was saying earlier, because I didn't really know what I was doing, like I didn't know anything about writing a novel. I just wrote it. It was pretty freeing just to write it out, you know? So the first draft, I think it took me, when I started it, I would say in 2018. That's when I wrote the first draft. And that took me maybe 2 months, eight weeks or so, to write the entire first draft. And then, you know, I had it edited. I had someone look at it, a professional. And I discovered that, you know, it was fraught with, you know, first writer mistakes. So that was something that I appreciate, you know, learning. I was kind of learning on the job at that point. So there was a lot of head hopping, a lot of use of adverbs I didn't need, and certain dialogue mistakes. So going back into it and correcting that, that is something that I did in the main kind of publishing process, which took several months and different levels of editing. So from start to finish, I would say for editing, it was probably closer to 6 months for just a different, you know, going over it with a fine tooth comb, removing those mistakes, rewriting, adding chapters, removing things in that nature. So yeah, so it would be nice to have that, you know, fresh out of the gate kind of new to it all feeling again. So just write freely and not worry about how things are necessarily structured. But so with that, that was a pretty quick process for me because the ideas were just rolling in and that was fun. But when you get down to business, it took several months to get it to where I thought it was good enough to publish.
So what lessons would you give to your, you have two daughters, and if yes. one of them said, Mom, I want to be a writer, mm-hmm. what lesson would you confer on her from your experience writing your first novel?
I would say then be a writer. Write, pay attention in school because they're both still in school. So pay attention in writing, which is something I didn't necessarily do, and learn what the rules are and take as many outside courses as you can, meet as many writers as you can, talk about writing and write. Just keep writing and it will all come together. You will figure it out. There are people out there that can help you who are skilled with editing and your readers that you can take from, but always remember what it is that you're trying to convey so you can be true to yourself.
I want to talk a little bit about your love of novels, and we're both fans of Their Eyes Were Watching God, but also you name check Invisible Man. Yes. And you have your character, John, said it's the single most important work of literature.
And I do appreciate that work for what it was and what it needed to be at the time it was published. And I do think that it was an extremely important book in its message and what the author was able to do with Ralph Ellison, was able to demonstrate in terms of what we can do and what we can accomplish if we are given the opportunity to do so. So I do agree with that. I do agree with John, but did I love it? No, it wasn't my favorite read, I will say. And I don't want anyone to hate me for that, but But I do.
All right. So are there any particular authors you look for inspiration?
The classics, of course, Zora Neale Hurston, that she, is a very prolific writer, or her short stories, because I've written a lot of short stories, and being an anthropologist as well as a novel writer, an article writer, I just think that, just the widespread talent that she had, and intelligence and influence that she still holds today. I think that she is the ultimate quintessential kind of writer's writer. So I would put her at the top of the list. Of course, there's Alice Walker and Toni Morrison. And, we can't forget those books that were super popular when I was a teen, Terry McMillan and B.B. Moore Campbell, and all of those lovely 90s
Waiting kind of to authors, Exhale,
Waiting to Exhale, Disappearing Acts. Yeah, all those things that, I would read as a teen and make me feel like a grown up, and I love authors who can kind of make you relate to the characters. And that's what I strive to do. That's my favorite thing, is characterization, dialogue, developing characters and their relationships. And, that's my favorite part of writing novels and writing stories, and touching people with, feeling like these people are real people that they might actually know or want to know.
Did any of those characters, did you dream of any of those characters? Did they hit your subconscious?
Like in actual dreams, do they come to me?
Right. I mean, not come to you, but did they sort of hit your subconscious at times, and you would start thinking about a character and it just comes out of the blue and say, oh, I need to make this change to the manuscript or the story?
Even now, I think I should have, done this with this character, because I think about all of the things that I've written, the characters that I've written come to my mind on a regular basis. So there's a lot going on, at times, and I can't, I bounce from story to story to character. And sometimes that's a good thing, because there are, characters and other stories that help me develop characters in the books and in other stories that I write. So that's a constant thing that my mind is doing, is thinking about characters. I think about, what they might like if I'm doing something. And it's, if I'm watching something or listening to something that happened in the 50s, I think about what my characters might have done or said or thought about that particular thing too.
So who would be your favorite character in this book? Not named Cheryl, not named Betty, not named John.
Other than
passing
them?
Notes. We're taking them off the table.
My
Who was
favorite.
Your favorite character to write outside of those three?
I actually enjoyed writing Donnie.
You like writing the villain, complicated villain.
Yeah, I liked writing Donnie. I liked Joey, Cheryl's sister.
Yes.
I enjoyed that. I mean, I enjoyed writing Mrs. Kavanaugh too, who is also a villain in the story.
Yes.
And Ruth as well, because they, where Ruth is a little, was the first employee or supervisor that Betty and Cheryl met when they went to start working at Birdseye. So I thought she was kind of funny. So I enjoyed writing her. But I definitely enjoyed the characters as well that introduce some of the conflict into the story.
All right. So your next novel, Are you working on it now? Can you share any details, or are you lips sealed?
I wrote passing notes, and then I wrote a second novel, which is about the characters in this book's grandson. So passing notes is really like the inception of a family secret. And the next book, which is titled right now, Results Will Vary, is about the consequences of that secret, because that's a contemporary novel set in, you know, our time in the 2000s, mostly.
Courtney Duke Foster, I really enjoyed reading this novel. I will tell you that I really did enjoy reading this novel. Thank you so much, author of Passing Notes.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.